Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Hello, hello, welcome friends. We are Life List, a birding podcast. I am George Armistead, and I am here with my co-host, Alvaro Jaramillo. Al, what's going on today?
Hi, how's it going? Migration is kind of starting, sort of. You know, West Coast migration, it's a real different deal. We've had huge amounts of migration already with shorebirds, but the warblers kind of trickle through here. They don't go big time, but vagrants start popping up. That's when we know the migration's happening. It's already, you know, lots of vagrants just showing up, eastern warblers, every day. Every day you look at the phone, and it's another day, another eastern vagrant.
Man. Well, we're getting some eastern warblers here too. They're a little more expected in this neck of the woods in Philadelphia. But yeah, I've been doing the occasional little, you know, dawn flight watch from the yard. We've had kind of a long string of warm weather here, but it looks like it's fixing to change. So far, I've not really seen, I don't have much to report, honestly. It's been a little lackluster. There's, you know, been birds trickling through. The one really noteworthy thing I would say so far is that there are a lot of Cape May warblers coming through, man. It's like,
oh yeah,
yeah. Like,
you know why?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I understand these spruce budworms are going off, I guess, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, that's. I heard a rumor, and I can't even remember from whom. Maybe it was just, you know, my Canadian birder friends saying something about it, or maybe just you know, if you've lived in Canada, you automatically sense budworm.
Maybe,
you know,
maybe it's the Nostradamus in you, you know?
Yeah, that's right. The I can sense it. I can sense budworm. So spruce, here's the story, kids. You think there's a lot of forest where you live? Well, there's amazing, huge amounts of forest well to the north of where most people live in Canada. And that boreal forest is essentially, I mean, mostly spruce. There's black spruce, white spruce, but spruce.
It's a bird factory up there.
Bird factory. And there are bogs, all sorts of spruce bogs where the black spruce will be more common. And, you know, the drier areas, more white spruce and so forth. But you have to imagine that up there, broadleaf trees are not all that common. You know, and if you find them, they tend to be, you know, things like birch, you know, and there'll be some willows, of course, and that type of thing. But it's a completely different type of forest, and it's mostly north of where we all live, and it gets attacked every so often by this insect, the budworm. I don't know, actually, if the budworm, it's funny, I've never even thought about it, if it's a fly or if it's a beetle. But in the budworm stage, it's in the, you know, it's eating up the spruce as a larvae. And then those things can be abundant, and they're cyclic, and they peak and ebb in different parts of the spruce forest, you know, different regions. And right now there's a huge, huge outbreak from what I've heard.
So the genus is Choristonura, and that's a genus of moth in the family.
Moth. There we go.
Tortricidae. Tortricidae, or they're called leaf roller moths.
Yeah, they're.
And they
roll a fatty with the spruce there. Is that what they're doing?
I think that's exactly what they're doing. Yeah.
That's why they're called budworm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, you're really putting this all together. Yeah.
And so these bugs feed, you know, so many warblers when they're in abundance that I gather the warblers can nest twice some of them anyways, just go like, oh my God, you know, it's like George with an open packet of chips. It's just like a foraging frenzy that, you know, it's almost unbearable to watch,
yes,
you know, because there's so much protein and food going, ingesting.
Mm-hmm.
And
nearly painted yourself in a corner on that one there.
Right there. And, you know, the budworm warblers, right? There's a lot of warblers in the north, but I think there's like the classic budworm warblers are Tennessee, Cape May, Bay-breasted, and Blackpoll. Is that right?
Yeah.
Am I on?
Those are the ones I associate, yes.
So those are, in theory, in certain parts of the forest, just did super well. So there should be tons of youngsters. And you're seeing them there as Cape Mays. Here, we are getting like every day multiple Tennessee warblers being seen. You know,
I had my earliest ever Tennessee here a couple weeks ago. I want to say it was like August 18th or something. I believe that is as early as I've ever seen a fall migrant Tennessee warbler. I'd have to double check, but I am not accustomed to seeing them, and usually until September. But yeah, the Cape Mays have been just, you know, pretty much, I'm to the point now where I'm like, can I see something other than a Cape May warbler? And I love Cape May warblers. Usually Cape May warblers are kind of an uncommon migrant, you know, like you have your days where you get, you know, good little push here and there of them. And, you know, some years appear to be better than others. And it's, you know, but they're just lately, it's every day when I'm out, that's the most common warbler I'm seeing right now.
Yeah. And I know that the Canadian, I'm not sure it's the government or the forestry folks or what have you. They spend a lot of money controlling budworm because the value of these trees for paper and all sorts of other, you know, even toilet paper is made from spruce, that they control the budworm. But I don't know why sometimes it still goes into the big numbers. Historically, this was a normal thing. Like in Peterson, you know, Roger Torrey Peterson's time, they knew when the budworm was doing well because they would see that certain warbler species were super common that fall. And then that has been tamped down by all this management. And the fact that it seems to have had this resurgence, I wonder if it has some other aspect involved, maybe like the fires didn't allow the spraying to happen or some other aspect of that I don't even understand, but I'm just creating opportunities for somebody to write in and tell us why.
Yeah. Well, Al, I did find, we were kind of chatting about this before. I found this article that came out in July, by the Wisconsin DNR Forestry News. And it says for the 11th consecutive year in Wisconsin, spruce budworm has caused significant defoliation of spruce, balsam fir, and tamarack. And it sounds like it's been ongoing for several years. 11 years in a row. And I do feel as though this is just, you know, my personal observations, but it seems like I've seen more Tennessee warblers in recent years and sticking around late into winter as well. It's not a bird I used to associate with like as a late lingering warbler, but now it's one of the most regular ones, certainly.
I will make a prediction.
Here we go.
That's Nostradamus. Prediction, folks, here it comes.
Let me
put on my special hat.
Oh boy.
And put my hands in the special motif of looking at the future.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it, right?
You're looking extremely thoughtful right now.
Sharp chin hawk juveniles, boom, this year. They're going to go up. I'm saying it.
Interesting.
Let's see if it happens.
I like that.
I was just talking
to Josh Koval, who is out in Montana doing a hawk watch there. And the bulk of their birds are excipitors. And he's saying their numbers this year are up overall, but the percentage of Coopers is higher than it's ever been before to this point. Now, it's still early in the season, but they're like twice normal. They're twice their normal numbers of total hawks coming through.
Cool.
And the bulk of what they get there typically is about 80% Sharpies. And right now, they're getting a lot of Cooper's hawks. So, go figure.
I do think that if we're going to get sort of a budworm, you know, situation that the hawks are being affected positively, it really will show up in that Cape May, you know, where they get a lot more juveniles and occipiters. You know, the Cape May Hawk Watch, I want to see what their numbers are this year.
Yeah,
I am keen on that.
I forget, they're the single day count. I'll see if I can find this for Sharpshin hawks is crazy. It's like back in the 70s.
Yeah.
We're never going to hit those numbers again, but like, it's just crazy to think. I forget how many it was, but it was like 22,000 or something. I forget.
You know, speaking of hawks and migration, the hawks down in Florida and the Keys, right? The Keys Hawk Observatory. What's the official name there? I'm just pulling things out of my head here. But they're tracking swallowtail kites, and it's really neat to see. I think they had four of them, swallowtail kites. Two of them went, as you kind of, you know, sort of expect today, you know, for a few years ago, we really didn't know what swallowtail kites just sort of disappeared. But then they appeared down south. We knew they went down to Central America, South America, but it wasn't clear what they were doing. So, but they're going down Florida, down to the Keys. Two of these crossed to Cuba, and not just any part in Cuba, westernmost Cuba, where a lot of birders don't go. So they actually, you know, most birders in Cuba or that have visited Cuba probably don't see swallowtail kites. And then they cross to the Yucatan from there, which makes complete sense. But two of the other ones went straight out over the water and did a full overwater crossing, not hopscotching on Cuba at all, heading to Mexico.
Oh, wow.
Which I thought was cool, very cool, or weird. And then you realize, like, I guess you can do that if you're a bird that can soar, just, you know,
they sail.
You don't need, sail, and, you know, you don't really need the updrafts of thermal kind of situation that you get on land, like broadwings. These birds are built in a different way. They're a little bit almost more like a frigate bird in some respects. You know, they can stay in the air with very little energy, you know. So I think that is an interesting thought process right there on what swallowtail kites are doing, you know, as a migrant. I was impressed.
You know? That's so pretty wild to picture.
Yeah.
I mean, just picture one of those things way out at sea, just kind of, I'm sure they'd be way up high, but yeah, it's crazy to think about. I did find the Cape May, October 4th, 1977. It was 22,000 total hawks that day, almost just shy of it. And 11,000 of those were Sharpies.
Huh. Wow.
It was a big, big day. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this shapes up.
But, for us, a lesson, I think that we never sort of learn as birders is that we always assume, right, that vagrancy and some of the birds that are found off course, or maybe even like when there's birds in the sea coming up north because the water is warmer, we assume that what's happening is where we are or the events of wind towards us or whatever is the reason we have these birds. Like, this is very mechanical, rather than what happened when they started. like
right.
yeah. the root area of where they were. That is the key. And I think with seabirds, you get the situation where it's like no food in the Galapagos. So boom, they go north or go south or go somewhere. And the fact that they might land where you are, where water might be warming, is because it's passable. It's bearable. It's not really great, but it's better than when you
where they were.
You should be.
Yeah.
And then for the warblers thing, you know, it's like I think we will get a lot of vagrants that will be the spruce buttworm vagrants this year. And some people will be like, oh my gosh, you know, why do we get so many? Did a storm move through? Did a wind thing move through? And, you know, and there'll be theories on this that it just means that there's more of them.
Right. It's bumper crop, basically.
Yeah,
and there's more of them everywhere. Yeah.
Right. So then you just get more vagrants because the proportion of vagrancy might be just constant. And you just get a bunch more because there's more of them. And I think that is something lost on a lot of the birder lore that we have. And we also, I'm starting to get like really anti-storm, you know, the anti-storm kind of situation where people think that every vagrant was brought somewhere by a storm. And it's like, right. No, they weren't. And most birds are not picked up from islands on storms.
Right.
We've talked about this before. But like the, you know, flamingos, that's a very specific situation. It's so weird, in fact, that it needs special conversation.
Right. Special examination. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Some study.
Otherwise, we'd have flamingos every time, you know, one of these storms went through an area that has flamingos, and we don't. So this is a key situation.
It is interesting with those flamingos, which I am happy to report, Alvaro, that my chase last week went well.
I heard you hopped on one leg just to make it a little bit more flamingo-y.
Now, see, it might be a little too soon to make that joke because I don't know if you heard, Al, but there's two flamingos in Pennsylvania, and one was taken in after it got nipped on the leg by a snapping turtle. And when I first heard that, I was like, oh no. Like, because I've seen white ibis and other herons sometimes lose, like, I've seen them be dragged into the water and vanish altogether at the beak of a snapping turtle. And I thought, geez. And other times I've seen them just lose their entire leg, you know, basically
this,
the snapping turtle.
This is of interest to me.
Yeah.
Because it's such a weird thing to consider. I mean, we don't have snapping turtles out here in the West, so we don't think of them as sort of this, you know, thing that's in there that's just about to chop legs off all over the place.
Yeah, they're lurking.
But they are common enough that shouldn't we see lots of waders without legs? Do you?
Yes and no. I guess like they're, I feel like we see a lot of shorebirds missing legs.
Maybe they get little fingers most of the time, so you can't notice, you know?
Yeah. But gulls, you see a lot of gulls with one leg. Now, it's a little tricky sometimes, right? Because sometimes they're just resting on one leg.
That's fishing line.
Yeah.
You know, my guess is gulls, it's fishing line usually.
Yeah. Because
we see that here a lot.
Yeah, and the truth is where the gulls go is not really where the snapping turtles are most of the time around here.
Yeah.
But I think like the Heinz Refuge here in Philly is loaded with snapping turtles. And it's pretty loaded with herons too. What you do see is I feel like I see herons flying with broken legs. Like they'll have one leg that's kind of kinked out or, you know, you're like, what happened there? And I'm not sure if that's due to snapping turtles or what, but yeah, it's a thing. Snapping turtles are a thing. So basically this one that got nailed in the back of the leg,
somebody saw this happen.
A guy saw it, went in and got the flamingo out of there and waited until the Pennsylvania Game Commission came and then took it into a rehab center. So one of the flamingos, took the guy
into a rehab center? For being so crazy?
No, well, yeah, I mean, you could argue that. I saw some pictures of him looking pretty heroic, but But yeah, no. So we're down to one flamingo there, and
wow,
yeah. Of course, you know, when I was there,
it was Steve Irwin, and just went all in. It's like, you know, I'm going to wrestle this turtle. Well, and
I do think, like, you know, I was there the day after Kristen and I took the dog up. We had a ton of fun, ton of people there. You know, it was a really good time. People were vibing out. There's a ton of Mennonites that live in the area. A lot of them came in. They were just like, what's happening here? What are you guys all, you know, like, you were here with your scopes and everything. And I saw every scope set up had, like, you know, a little crowd of locals coming to look through it and check out these flamingos. And they'd kind of see it in the distance, but then they look in the scope and they'd be like, oh my God, like, oh, like, you got to see this. You know, they turned to their friends, you got to see this. And, and it was pretty cool to have that interaction with a bunch of folks that are not used to a whole lot of visitation, you know, out there.
Right.
Sort of near Chambersburg in
Mennonites.
Yeah. Yeah. And
if there were Amish people, they would already know, they would have found the flamingos.
Yeah, that's right.
They would have found the flamingos and put the word out.
A lot of Amish birds.
A lot of birders in the Amish world.
That's true. Yeah. But yeah, it was like just kind of like a big party. You know, everybody was hanging out, enjoying the flamingos. But as I was driving back, you know, and it really was a ton of fun to get there, see everybody, enjoy the birds, you know, and just, it's so weird, right? Like you go to there's this pond on the side of a country road. It couldn't really be a better setup for, you know, for a Twitch where, you know, there's easy parking on the side of the road. There's hardly any traffic, you know, so people just pull over on the side of the road, get out and, you know. You know, Bob's your uncle. You're there. You're watching your flamingos, and so it was a ton of fun. But on the ride back, I was like, you know, and that's what all the locals were asking, right? They're like, what's going to happen to these things? You know, like, well, what are they going to do when it gets too cold? And I was like, I mean, that's the million dollar question. Yeah, we're all wondering that. But I do, you know, we were talking last time with Molly about how, you know. You were saying, wouldn't it be so cool if, like, some of these banded birds, the Pennsylvania ones weren't banded, but some of the other ones are, you know, were banded down in Celestine, if they were found back down in Cuba or in Celestine or something by biologists, and they were able to report back that some of these birds had actually made it back. That would be amazing. But I mean, I feel like it's going to end badly, you know. I feel like these, you know, I hope not, but I wonder if this first one getting nabbed by the, you know, it only was cut on its leg. It did not lose its whole leg, but you could see it was bleeding down the back of the leg, and I don't know if it had any critical tendons or what, but.
Was it the older one or the younger one?
It was the smaller, paler one, which
okay.
I think several of us had kind of figured as the other one was big and tall and bright pink, and the other one was noticeably smaller and much whiter. I think we'd all kind of figured it was probably a younger female.
Second year.
Yeah, that was kind of the thinking. So yeah, it was the second year female that got hit by the snapper. We'll see, man. But yeah, I feel like people need to brace themselves for what could be an uncomfortable ride watching these flamingos.
But are they still around? I mean, most of these, I mean, those are there, but have the other ones that people have been seeing, are they still around or have they filtered away already?
I think the coastal ones, you know, they're in a better position to move around. So a lot of the ones like Florida ones, Carolina ones, Gulf Coast ones, I haven't looked at all the records, but I think those are mostly just coastal. And those birds probably move around pretty easily.
Are they still being seen in the same places or have they gone?
I don't know, but the North Carolina ones, I believe, are gone. I'm not sure about the inland ones further north. My understanding was that the Ohio ones had pushed on. So
then maybe it's not ending badly. Look at, you know, come on.
Well, unless they end up in, you know, Ontario next or, you know, Bozeman, Montana.
but there's free healthcare in Ontario.
That's a very good
residents.
Point.
So yeah. You know, if you get hit by a turtle, they'll patch you up right there.
Yeah, could be
in charge. And they'll fly you to Cuba because you can fly direct from Toronto to Havana.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't know, man. I'm not sure they'll be able to take advantage of that much as we all might wish it.
Yeah. You know, this has become a less popular, not popular, maybe it didn't used to even be an issue, but we have so many people now that like nature, right, as opposed to in the past. That we used to really worry mostly about population level issues, like individual birds or not. It didn't sort of come into the question. You sort of were sort of part of the way of the world. It's, you know, some make it, some don't. Things happen. But today I find that it's much harder to publicly have that opinion because people see you as a heartless, you know, person. But it, in a sense, that is truly the thing that matters, right?
Like
that we have flamingos, that we have a healthy flamingo population down south, that they're breeding, and that those things are taken care of. Whether the 2, 3, 4, 10, 100 that are up here all survive or not may not have much of
an impact on the global population.
But it has a huge impact on individual people.
Yeah, it has a big emotional impact.
Emotional impact.
Yeah.
And physical impact sometimes. I mean, people feel it big time, you know, like in a visceral kind of way.
Yeah.
So I do feel one has to keep an eye on the population level situations. That is of importance. And there are probably ways to even help out some of the flamingo programs that are down south, either, you know, the banding or, you know, work that's being done to preserve the sites where they breed, et cetera. You know, we can maybe find some links to that, but that might be the way to sort of channel your concern, right?
That's a good point. And I'm sure that you got to figure a place like Celestine Biosphere down in Yucatan Peninsula where that big flock of American flamingos is a huge tourist draw, not just birders, you know, like lots of people go there to see those flamingos.
I think there's some places in Cuba as well, in Bahamas, right? Where the same situation happens.
And but I think those could be good areas to try to direct conservation and funds if you're so inclined. Another good place for flamingos, Alvaro, is
Los Flamencos.
The town of Los Flamencos. Yes, on the coast of Colombia. That's been making news lately. Making some waves down there.
Los Flamencos, is it National Reserve? Reserva Nacional Los Flamencos.
Yeah.
I think it's a
sanctuario, I think.
Is this okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a good place anyway. It's a good place.
It is a real good place. And it's not just a good place for birds. It's a good place for seafood. And the town where Los Flamencos Sanctuary is called Camarones.
And, Camarones.
And the shrimp there is good. I can vouch for that. But our friends, Chris Bell.
Coconut shrimp.
Coconut shrimp, that's the way to go, Our friends Chris Bell and Steve Huggins and some others have had quite a time down there these last couple of days, right? They had 2 days in a row finding some very rare chorlitos, right? Some rare plovers. First day, they had themselves a piping plover, the first one ever for Colombia, and I don't know how many records there are for South America for that species. And then the second day, right after that, they had a lesser sand plover in pretty much the same spot. Craziness. Both firsts for Columbia, both real good vagrants. I mean, the piping plover is a bit more expected, right? You kind of figured that's going to happen at some point. But lesser sand plover is some nutty business.
It's going to be split, though. They better have the goods on which one.
Well, they got some good photos.
Siberian,
I don't know if that'll help.
Siberian.
And Tibetan, right? But I think Siberian's probably the only likely vagrant, right?
Oh, you never know. Never know.
Yeah.
That's pretty good luck. I mean, we've talked about it. That place has vagrant shorebird, gull, tern written all over it, you know?
Yeah. The first time you and I went, we were looking at a flock of like, I want to say it was like 12 or 15 gulls, and it was almost an even mix, I think, of lesser blackback gulls and kelp gulls. And
yeah.
It was sort of like, how many places can you go and see that?
Yeah, see that. And there were herring gulls, which are, you know, not amazingly common in South America, flying by, and all sorts of terns that in the mix.
Yeah.
And a lot of shorebirds that weren't accessible, like they were far away. So you could tell, oh gosh, if you had more access to this, this probably annually has all sorts of weird species and also numbers of the common stuff. I mean, yeah. it was really good.
They have flamingos. Yeah, exactly. They got a big bunch of flamingos, although it's often difficult to see. Usually, in my experience, you got to take a boat out to get to where they're at. But then you get there and you might have a couple hundred if you're lucky.
And there's scarlet ibis.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And also roseate spoonbills.
Mm-hmm. A lot of pink birds. You like pink birds. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of stuff that's red and pink. Mm-hmm. And the, do you remember the Rey del Bosque? Do you know that guy?
El Rey del Bosque, el Rey de la Guajira.
I think it's is it Rey de la Guajira? Is that what it's called?
Okay. Yeah. Or actually, I think it's El Rey Guajiro.
Rey Guajiro, Vermilion cardinal. That's a good looking bird.
Yeah,
that is. That makes regular cardinal, northern cardinal, look, you know,
a little mundane.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you go to Arizona and you see those northern cardinals there, and you're like, whoa, look at these.
They need to split those southwestern ones, man. Those they feel like they're brighter red, longer crest, you know. They're really those southwestern northern cardinals. But yes, vermilion cardinal is pretty spectacular bird. And those and Paraloxia are the only three in that genus. So there's quite a few other birds called cardinals, but these are the only three that are in that genus.
Yeah. True cardinals.
Yes.
You could call them the true cardinals, the real cardinals. Yeah, I do think that there's two more called cardinals, but they're actually not even closely related. Not even the same.
Yeah, there's like red-capped cardinal and masked cardinal and yellow cardinal.
Yellow cardinal is its own genus, and then all the other ones are in that red-crested cardinal group, right?
Parioria? I'm trying to remember the genus.
Yeah, and they are actually tanagers related to, they're sort of tanagers that walk. They're sort of weird in that they walk rather than hop.
Yeah.
And
they kind of look like cardinals because they have a lot of red crest, but otherwise they're kind of black and white plumaged things.
Yeah.
But yeah, Paroaria or Paroaria.
And then yellow cardinal is a different genus. So
that's a cool one.
And that's got a crest. That's the only reason you call it cardinal. It has nothing else that's cardinal-like.
It is badass something. Bird. It's a badass bird.
Start with a G.
Gubernatrix.
Gubernatrix.
Cristata. Also a tanager.
Well, cardinals are in the cardinal grosbeaks, right? They have their own family.
Have you seen yellow cardinal? Is that
Yep. Back in the day in Argentina.
Oh sure, yeah. You would have seen it when you were probably working on your.
I'm hoping we'll see it in Uruguay this December. Probably have a lot of these places where you see it are secret because they are so
heavily pursued
for the cage bird trade.
Same as vermilion cardinal
in the south. Yeah, you know so. So they keep them secret. Don't tell about anybody about them, and that's how they survive.
Yeah, I kind of the ones I first saw in Argentina, I knew that they were heavily pursued for the cage bird trade, and we'd been looking for them all over at a spot that they were like kind of well known near that town Las Grutas on the coast of Argentina, which is a cool town. And we were like looking around for it, and finally, I like some guy like saw us birding on the side of one of the main roads there. And he's like, I forget how he said it in Espanol, in Castellano. You know, he was like, are you looking for the yellow cardinal? And I was like, yeah. He's like, well, we got him over here. And it was one of those things where I was like, man, I don't know. Is this guy, he's going to have me looking at like a yellow finch or something, or, you know, and I was like, got to give it a try. Cause at this point the whole group heard him say it and they're like, oh, well, here we go. We got to go, you know? And I was like, man, I got a bad feeling about this. But we followed the guy down I don't know, it was like a 6-kilometer dirt road that was really rough, and got to some dusty old garage in the middle of nowhere. And I'm looking around, I'm like, I mean, there could be one here, but, you know, we went through a lot of habitat, looks fine for him. And like within a minute, you know, a male flies in and starts calling. And I was like, well, look at that. He really did have one. Yeah. And it was like, you know, often people will be like, well, I got one in my backyard. And you're like, yeah, no, you don't, you know? Yeah. And this guy totally nailed it, knew what it was. And it's a private ranch. I was like, thank you very much.
I found that guys, it's always a guy in Argentina. They know all of the finches that you can actually keep in a cage. They know them because somebody in their family or themselves used to be interested in them, whether it's seed eaters, you know, the chestnut seed eaters, things that some of them are, you know, pretty rare or hard to find, to siskins and anything like that. They know them all and know them well, know the calls. You know, I remember even having one driver once who was like kept cage birds, and he'd be driving around with the window open and was like, oh, here's a seed eater right here. I'm hearing one. And we was like, seriously? I'm like, oh, he's right. You know, they're just totally dialed in to the cage birds because there's such a big deal over there. And makes so many sense. Birds are actually in conservation concern because of how they capture the males, right?
Yeah.
With using other males to trap them. And then the males always come to look at other males and, you know, in the territorial
defend their
time,
territory. Defend yeah. Their territory. They can't resist.
Can't resist. So they get trapped. I mean, it's just like, boom, another male out of the population. Yeah. But, it is odd how common, you know, cage birds are there. I gather it's the same in southern Brazil and parts of Mexico, but like Chileans don't keep birds in cages much, like not at that level.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see it in Ecuador or Peru. It's like very specific. And when I've talked to the birders in Argentina, they blame their Italian heritage. Is that some of the old first immigrants from Italy came with that idea of keeping canaries and finches, bullfinches and all that kind of stuff.
It stayed.
Yeah. Yeah. Ingrained. And they'll take them for a walk. Like you'll see the little old guys in the park with a little cage with their finch, and they go to the park and they have a hook on a tree and they put the cage on the tree. And another guy comes over, his friend, you know, puts his bird on the adjacent tree, and they sing to each other, and the guys sit and talk, and then they take them home. It's so weird. I mean, they do like the birds, but you wish that they could like turn this love of birds into something a little bit more positive.
That was healthier for the bird itself. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. What you were saying about that might have come from the Italian heritage, and it reminded me of a quote that an Argentine friend of mine once told me, which is that Argentines are Germans pretending to be Italians that speak Spanish.
They're not really, there's not that many Germans, but yeah, I could get the general gist. Yeah.
There are a lot of Italians.
Yeah, most, I think, you know, I mean, other than Spanish last names, Italian last names are the commonest.
Yeah.
But
Messi among them.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a cool country. I do like visiting Argentina. I do find that it might be, you know, we are enamored with the big checklists of some of the more tropical areas, but in terms of diversity of the types of birds you see, Argentina might be right up there. Like big birds, seabirds, tanagers, finches, tinamous. You know, you start putting it all together and it's a real diversity because, you know, you go, and toucans and all that, you know, parrots. You go to Ecuador or somewhere, it's much fewer sort of types of birds you see, but many more species within each realm of the tanagers or the, you know, ant birds and so forth. And some showy birds in the Argentina, in the tapaculos, and even like the fernariads, the oven birds, some the really showy, crazy
the,
ones. You know?
The oven birds, the fernariads, I feel like are where Argentina and the tyrannids, I feel like are where Argentina really shines. Like there's obviously a lot of tyrannids all over the world, but you know, there's monjitas and you know, just a bunch of cool, bigger flycatchers.
Strange tailed.
Yeah. And I think what, you know, obviously Argentina, it covers a lot of latitude. I think it's like the seventh or eighth largest country in the world. It's a big country. Mm-hmm. And and it covers a lot of latitude. So you got a tremendous amount of diversity, and there is a good field guide for it now, which I think we mentioned before. But it's got a lot going for it, from Iguazu Falls, which is basically tropical, right, and down to the Ibirá Marshes south of that, to the Pampas south of that, then all you know go all the way further south to the Patagonian steppes and eventually Tierra del Fuego, and that's to say nothing of the west, you know. Where you've
the mountains, high mountains.
Yeah. You've got the Altiplano. You've got the Monte.
The Chaco.
The Chaco, which is, there's less and less of that all the time, I gather, but still some good chunks there. I think the highest number of doves I've ever seen anywhere in the world was in the Chaco. There were areas there I remember just seeing, like, you're just driving along flushing hundreds of eared doves and picui ground doves, just hundreds upon hundreds until you're well into the thousands, you know. I think, remember Dave Stasekel and I think we estimated something like 20,000 total doves that day. It's, you know, it's hard to estimate, but it's just crazy.
There's a place like that too in Uruguay that's just masses of doves, so much so that they're cooing. Like when they're sitting in the trees, you just hear this hum and just thousands upon thousands of doves.
Like you can't actually thinking, make out individual sounds. It's just sort of a collective hum of
like insects. Mm-hmm. And you think, what I cannot understand is you go there and it's like, what's special about this place? Why here? Like, why not? I don't know. Why so many doves? And there must be something. Maybe there's like a spruce budworm of the doves. Ooh. You know?
Yeah.
something interesting in there. But when I've been in that situation, it is the only time I have felt like, okay, now I know what the passenger pigeon scene must have been like.
That's exactly what it made me think of. It's like, man, maybe this is what it was like, you know? Maybe that's what it was like.
Yeah, they're just everywhere, you know? Like flying around and just call. Yeah. Next time I'm going to take video because it really is spectacular, that dove place.
Yeah.
The doves.
Chaco is fun. I know, world lister Ross Gilardi, local here in Pennsylvania, he is heading there soon, going after a bunch of, there's a bunch of endemics in Argentina and a bunch of stuff that is either close to endemic, maybe barely gets into Chile or neighboring, you know, Bolivia, Uruguay, Paraguay. But, it really is a tremendous place to go birding. Kind of the popular spots are the Northwest, Patagonia and Tierra del Fuego, or all the way up in the Northeast. But it's got a lot going on.
Yeah. You know, the southern birders, some of them keep a southern cone list. And that's it's a really neat part of South America. And it's essentially, I think in the end, it was, first, it was sort of a line, you know, a latitude line south of there. But then they thought, no, that's really too difficult. So I think they just included, it's Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay. I don't think maybe they include Rio Grande do Sul in Brazil. as well as the Falklands, and it's like quite a cool list of birds mm-hmm. when you get into it. It's just sort of so many unique things and a lot of things you cannot see in northern South America. You know, it really divides nicely into this more tropical realm to this more, you know, southern temperate subtropical realm, and culturally too, really sort of division in South America. So work on your southern cone list and you'll see a lot of cool birds.
Yeah. Remember, you know, when I was thinking about Steve Huggins and Chris Bell and their two plovers recently, I was like, man, that place could really stand more attention. You know, as we've discussed, you know, that Camarones Flamenco Sanctuary, the waters there, you just know that, you know, probably bar-tailed godwits are pitching in there and ruffs and even rarer stuff like they've proven in the last week. And another spot like that is that Punta Raza in Argentina there, where you spend a lot of time. I've spent some time as well. But like people talk about Cape May being this, you know, not only a migration mecca, but also like a real vagrant migrant trap. And Punta Raza is very much that way as well. And I do think it'd be fun to do, you know, all of us want to go to these places and see the common expected birds, but doing a little vagrant hunting in some of these vagrant trap places, you know, you could really turn up some birds that people just would have way off their radar. And Punta Raza would be a fun place to go spend some more time during peak migration seasons.
Do you know that I once wrote a small paper called, and the title was Punta Raza, South America's First Vagrant Trap?
You know, I don't remember that title, but I think you sent me that article years ago. I was going down there.
Had a bunch of things, you know, and at that time, some of the cooler ones hadn't even been found yet, you know.
Right.
There's been Terek sandpiper there now.
Oh, and, man.
Eurasian curlew showed up.
Wow.
But we hadn't some northern stuff, you know, like one of the short-tailed nighthawks. I forget what is rufous-bellied or, you know, vagrant swifts and vagrant flycatchers, eastern kingbirds, and things like mm-hmm. that are further south than they should be.
I had a Mississippi kite on tour there.
We had Plumbius kite too. That's right. We had Plumbius. That was mm-hmm. another. So it's just, you know, I'm sure if there are, you know, multiple vagrant finder birders there, there's some good birders there that have found some cool stuff over the years. But, you know, if you had kind of the number of eyes at some place like Cape May does.
Oh, yeah. Probably that little lighthouse area. Things. Like not as rare as the things you just mentioned, but like I remember we had a Duca finch there, common Duca finch. And it, you know, it gets stuff from the south as well. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful spot. And I actually dream of going back there and just hanging out for a while because I spent so much time there. And before I even knew some aspects of birding that I probably know now, you know, I'm going to go back as a seasoned birder.
Now you were there working on the bay wings, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The bay wings and screaming cowbirds, shiny cowbirds, all that stuff.
Yeah. The bay wings, people probably don't know a lot about that and how the juvenile screaming cowbirds, right? Look a lot like bay wings and that whole dynamic.
Well, they're mimics. They're complete mimics. They're not related to each other.
Right.
And they look exactly the same. So while the cowbird parasitizes the bay wing and it mimics everything it does and looks like, you know, looks like it and so forth. And then the moment it fledges, it molts its bay wing type plumage, which is the gray dark mask, rusty wings, into a fully black plumage. And not only do they molt out of that, they change their voice. They start sounding like screaming cowbirds rather than all the sounds of the bay wing.
I forget about that.
It's crazy.
That is crazy.
It's crazy. You know, I mean, I got to see that up close and personal, like just to see how it happens.
Now, they all used to be Molothrus, right? And now in the brown-headed cavern.
That was like decades ago before DNA. So they're not even closely related. Yeah.
I knew that they weren't anymore. I was trying to remember. But yeah, Aguloides is grayish bay wing now. But there's multiple bay wings.
Yeah, it's most closely related to that. The bay wings are most closely related to a bird called the Bolivian blackbird. And for a long time, like you said, because they were all considered cowbirds, it was called the bay wing cowbird. And although English names are just English names, I thought in this case it was really important to do away with the cowbird name, because the biology of this bird relates to cowbirds, but it's not a cowbird. It's the host of the cowbirds. So that's why, I mean, I argued for it to just be called baywing. Call this thing the baywing. And just as a one-word name. You know me with my one-word names. And the committee said, okay, but we're going to call it grayish baywing. I was like, oh, you ruined it. It should have been baywing.
You're right, man. I think you're standing then they split. Ground.
Yeah, they split the other one, the now called pale baywing, which could have been called something else. But, you know, there you go. Those were cool birds that I got to sit and study. And it's still one of those things where I remember that I had banded birds. And I would go in the morning and just watch them for hours, like watch what individual birds did. And I would track down the behaviors and stuff and all this. And I've never done that again, that level of focus on individual birds. But you would see these things that you would never see just birding. Like sometimes they would do a certain behavior, or they go and sit and kind of sleep for a bit, or they would do other, you know, they completely go nuts when a hawk went over, and how you could see how that shifted. You know, you'd be watching them for hours and nothing had happened. Then their entire demeanor changes. And it was really eye-opening to do that single animal focus and just go with it. And if you could, as a birder, just if you're interested in that kind of thing, just do it, you know, like watch for a while. It's amazing what you see. Once you see stuff, you're like, I cannot believe this is happening all around me. And because I see snippets of it, I don't notice the whole context.
That was a question Molly raised a while back. I remember she was like, how often do you just watch one bird for an extended period of time? And we do end up doing that sometimes with vagrants, right? Because you actually make a twitch, but you know, it's too often. That's not a really great. Necessarily, it can be, but it's not necessarily a great way, because very often there's a bunch of people there that are kind of distracting you. But I remember on the prairies trip I did last summer, where we found a McCown's thick-billed longspur nest, you know, on the ground, female, and I actually spotted her on eggs, and you know she was not going to leave. And, you know, like she was like probably just 3 feet in front of me. And so I moved back a bit and got down on the ground and just started watching her, you know, and just sat there for probably like 40 minutes. And I remember at one point I started to see her kind of get up and stretch and look around a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think much of it at the time, but then like, you know, I was videoing, and in the background you can hear my friend Liam Hart, he goes, prairie falcon, you know, and then in the video, you can see way behind it, there's this prairie falcon kind of rips through. But that longspur, you know, was like, I would never notice it, but it was just stretching a little bit to get a better view of this predator that it had already picked up on, you know, and you can see that clearly in the video. But yeah, that's just one of those little things you start to realize how they behave. And you know, I was watching a goldfinch here the other day that got in under all these pollinator plants, and he was just kind of preening in the dust there. He wasn't feeding, and eventually he just fell asleep, you know, and I watched him on the ground just kind of take a nap. And I was like, how cool is that? You know, just like just watching this guy hang out, do his thing.
Wow. Well, with, you know, the real sad part of my my research. This is when you realize, you know, maybe you're not fully, you know, good at research. It's when I was doing all that work. And I had a really, Bruce Lyon is, he's actually a professor here now in Santa Cruz. He's a really well-known person in terms of coots and all of this other interest. All these birds have interesting behavior. They've worked on a lot of stuff, but he, at that point in time, he was studying the black-headed duck, right? Parasitic duck. And he helped me.
It's the only one that's purely a brood parasite, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's the only duck that is purely a brood parasite.
Yeah. It's the only bird with precocial young that is strictly brood parasitic. So it's really key bird to understand. And he was studying them in the same time that I was studying these cobras. He had his PhD and the whole thing, and he was truly a good researcher. So he suggested I do some, try to figure out how the mimicry works. So I'd actually had control and experimental birds that I took, you know, markers, and I made them, I took all the red out of their wings, the juveniles, so that they would look black instead of looking like bay wings. And then my idea was to see if they would be fed less, you know, to see if the mimic or what it actually was, you know. So I had this whole thing going on, and it was all going very well. You know, I had a few, it took a long time to get to these nests, but then a huge thunderstorm went by, like one afternoon, like massive, like the kind that really Argentina is known for. You hailstorm the whole thing. And essentially, nearly every breeding bird in my, like, not just the cowbird, like the bay wings, everything just died.
Oh,
like the adults were still there, you know, but the youngsters, anything that was in a nest or was being fed, they all croaked.
Man.
And so my entire experiment was gone. Like, it was just evaporated. Like
overnight was done.
Overnight was done. And I'd had been measuring eggs before that. So I eventually worked on the egg mimicry situation. But the one on plumage would have been amazing if it had worked. Would have been really cool. And the thought was like, okay, well, you know, you're going to come back next season and try this again. I'm like, no, I'm done. I'm 2 years. That's what I got funding for. I'm gonna write this up and get out of here because
I
did my time, and I felt like any of these things you could keep going forever on them, you know. And I really was sort of like, you know, cut your losses when you can. I knew I had enough to actually get my master's and just wrote that up and did it. But I do wonder sometimes, like, if that had worked and I'd had, you know, a real nice, you know, they were fed 20% less than the other ones, or there was some other aspect that was happening, it would have been a really, really interesting publication. But, you know, it just never was.
Yeah.
No.
Wasn't meant to be.
Wasn't meant to be.
Yeah.
So it was fun, though, to do all that. And hang out there and live there.
It's a nice part of the world.
Get invited to the local barbecues.
Yeah, the parejas. Yeah. What's going on?
I know. I was big buddies with the local gaucho. We'd hang out and drink mate. And he'd bring out his guitar and sing sad songs about the pampas. And I was like, that's pretty cool. You know? The things that happen when you're doing research.
Yeah. It sounds like a book in and of itself.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Maybe I should do my memoirs.
Yes, absolutely. Complete.
Nostra dumbass.
No omissions.
No omissions, yeah. Mm-hmm. It won't be nearly as interesting as, like, you know, Dorian's early years. So.
So probably not as salacious anyway, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, amigo, we should wander yonder, I reckon.
Can I say just one last thing?
Yes, sir.
One last thing. We were on a pelagic trip on Saturday, and Dario Taborelli, right? He's a birder here, but he's originally from Italy. And he said, you know, the take on pizza with pineapple, the Hawaiian pizza, he said, that should be illegal. He's on your side. He said, speaking as a person who grew up with cheese, tomatoes, you know, good, you know, solid Italian pizza, this is bad, very bad. Mm-hmm. It should never happen. And I was like, okay, from you, Dario? Yeah, I'm.
Oh,
I'm,
so from him, you think it comes with some legitimacy, huh?
But yes, for me, but maybe 2 hours later, we were out there, and Eli Gross spots a Hawaiian petrel, which was, you know, kind of a lifer for everybody. I said, Dario, today you have to eat Hawaiian pizza. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And he said, fair enough. Fair enough. One time. Mm-hmm. So there you go. It was a sign. There's Hawaiian.
I would eat Hawaiian pizza if it meant that I got to see a Hawaiian petrel. I would have a
slice. There you go.
Yeah, I would do that. I think that's legit. Yeah. Well, I'm happy to hear that somebody is talking some sense into you on this. Somebody with some expertise. Dario.
Look, I'm open-minded. Yeah. I'm open-minded. I'm taking in the recommendations and viewpoints. I may not change mine. But in effect, almost anybody's opinion I would value higher than yours, George. So
I believe that. I believe that story. Yeah. There's some truth there. Well, Dario, I appreciate you. Thank you very much. Please continue to spend time birding with Alvaro because he needs you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So thank you. Sorry to have, got you off track on finishing up the podcast.
No,
here,
not
George.
At all. Well worthwhile. Thank you, Dario. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we will be back again real soon. Al, you have a good one. We'll talk soon.
Thanks. Bye-bye, everybody.